I trust that you will receive it in a spirit of brotherly love. I admit to some confusion, if only because out of the circumstances in which I left my home base of Detroit. We had a baseball strike there early in the week. The object of the exercise, I believe, was to convince Michigan fandom that hereafter our locals should be known as the Pauper Tigers. But unlike other American metropoli, the new international comedy came to our relief. On the day scheduled for our opener that did not open, a team of 12 players from Red China came to us. They were at once rushed to the 16th floor of the Sheraton Cadillac, the Detroit counterpart of our meeting place, where they held forth in solitude, thanks to 14 G-men sent from Washington to ensure that they would see, speak, and hear no evil like the little monkeys of Nico, and least of all should they deal with the press. And this novelty in people-to-people communication is here cited only as an example of the over-classification of humans, which I suggest to you is a far sadder affliction to government than the security handling of paper could ever be. My larger concern, however, is with the historic implications of what we see. Five or so centuries ago, the Western world wished to open up China. And that's how China got polo. And this much later, with China seeking to open our minds, we get ping pong. And that hardly puts us one up. Hence my feelings about my task, burdened as they are with confusions, are not unlike those of the two Micks passing Scotland Yard, and they see a sign saying, "Two Irishmen wanted for murder." And they went into the sergeant at the desk and they said, "We're your man. We're ready to take on the job." And somewhat perplexed, the sergeant went in to talk to the superintendent. And as he did so, leaving his desk, they walked into another room where they saw a second sign saying, "Two Jamaicans wanted for rape." And one turns to the other and says, "Them black folks get all of the good jobs." Well, like those two hearties, I volunteer only to serve as a murder board. I see no likelihood of panaceas to our national security evolving from diplomatic maneuver and manipulation. Lately, I was at a three-day seminar of serious thinkers on the national strategy, the setting being Airlie House in Warrenton, Virginia. And about half of the gathering was composed of scholars from the campuses. And their nigh unanimous theme was that a multipolar power-centered Earth was coming on at such a clip. And they cite as examples India, Japan, China, and free Europe collectively at such a clip that any number of peacekeeping options heretofore undreamed were opening to the United States. Being one of the few military hard hats present, I could not agree. No global turnaround may be brought about that soon. And that smoothly. As we used to remark in Texas about 10 years in the penitentiary, what is easy to say comes very hard to do, and one might better take 10 days in the electric chair. My friend General Lew Walt of the Marines has a forthcoming book entitled The Coming Defeat of the United States. He sent me the proofs, and I read it a few weeks ago. His is an outlook much gloomier than mine. It is almost the Spenglerian view of our future. The position of the climber on the alpine crag who must press on, for with one look backward into the dizzying abyss, he is forever done. My reading is more like that of the foreign motorist on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. He passes a sign 10 miles to Philadelphia, and he goes on another 10 miles, and here's another sign saying 14 miles to Philadelphia, and then he goes on another 10 miles, and here's a sign saying 15 miles to Philadelphia, and he breathes a sigh of relief and says, well, thank God I'm almost holding my own. So I would say to you of the Philadelphia Society that if out of our Vietnam involvement we find ourselves in the unhappy state of the well-fed female kennel bitch that tries to form a nest out of flypaper, and we have one such pup, that's one reason we don't have flypaper in the house. If we were in that situation, it is not because we engaged, but that in so doing and afterward, and from the highest level, we as a people and government recklessly violated both the principles of war and the first rules of what must be done to keep coherent a free society. 1 week ago, I heard the Veep, Spiro Agnew, talk to the soldiers of the 101st Division Air Mobile on the return of their colors to the United States at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Those colors had been in the fighting line in Vietnam since 1965, 7 years, longer than any colors lofted in battle in any of our wars. Mr. Agnew is the favored target of the media of this country, mainly because his words, out of truth, hit home, and truth unvarnished is hard to take, especially by the press. He said to these soldiers what they needed to hear, that they had fought the good fight, and the cause that put them on the other side of the globe may well have been out of the most generous impulse ever to carry our country into a war. I read our history as does he, though I don't believe in stumbling toward an objective, nor does Mr. Agnew. But he didn't make the policy that matured through 5 presidents. I am not a partisan in politics. I guess I'm a mugwump, that being a small bird that sits on a fence with his mug on one side and his wump on the other. And further, I believe that democracies can ill afford to make saints and heroes of their public men. But I will support Mr. Nixon because I believe he is doing the best possible for the United States at the present pass. And also because I see nothing sensible with relation to the national security coming from anybody on the other side except Senator Scoop Jackson. That doesn't mean that I am trying to qualify here as an expert on election, an expert being one who can hit the bullseye without shooting the bull. Last night I heard Dr. Kurt play the pundit on the subject of bayonets, quoting to the effect that one may do anything with it but sit on it. It so happens that I have been present at the only successful bayonet charges by our forces in this century, and I have written more about the weapon than anyone alive. So I counter what he said, adding that the statement is false. The point is the smallest thing about a bayonet, and you may sit on it anywhere else and not get hurt, though you have no calluses where sitting is done. But since it doesn't operate like a rocking chair, why bother? To what I've already said about Vietnam, I add that the serious thinkers who sold the Pentagon on the notion that there is a new special science called limited war were as misguided as Diogenes when he used only one small lamp in his search for an honest man. I'm not talking about the fustus and the mostus, but I'm talking about quickly with enough to get the job done. There isn't any other way to prosecute war. I believe absolutely that at a time when the United States sees its military power in decline, with more pairing to come, with the favor and affection of the people for the armed force in greater chill than ever before in our history, we should be thinking less about a giant leap forward to a new strategy and doing more about rebuilding the strategy we've got. New initiatives toward more favorable arrangements with our power rivals have their place in the scheme of things. No one may object in common sense to this, but we should also remember the injunction of the Sphinx when the Anzac soldier asked her for the digested wisdom of the ages, and she said, "Don't expect too much." That Joe Enlai sweats, or says he does, over the danger of a remilitarized Japan doesn't concern me one bit. I do care, however, that Japan is doing so little to rearm in sensible proportion to her treasure and position, and that we are more annoyed that she is making most of the nuts, bolts, and screws sold in America than that she leans on our power like a drunk hugging a lamppost. I think it deplorable that we have made ambiguous our position as to Taiwan. Ambiguity nourishes war danger. It is a common foible of diplomacy and its greatest failing. I know that island and its people from long acquaintance. They will not yield their independent position, and if attacked, they will go to war, and they will do well. If I were suggesting a point where the next war is likely to start, I would say Big Quemoy Island. As to ourselves, if we do not have adequate and balanced forces, no strategy, new or old, will long avail us, for we will have forfeited our credit. Even the most benighted state would rate us a dubious risk as a military partner. One danger I see ahead is the prospect that given a few years of no war, the U.S. will once again discount the imperative of sufficient conventional power in preserving the balance for peace. I have been saying it for 25 years that we must have it if Dr. Strangelove is to remain a theme for laughter only. For as Clausewitz well said, it's never the aggressor that makes a war. It's his victim. He always has the other choice of laying down. I said 25 years ago, not long ago, I was recalled to the general staff to write high policy. I found that the chairman of the JCS and the chief of staff of the Army and the secretary of the Army had all concluded that armies had had their day and their future would be mainly as police forces. For the next several months, I wrote their speeches to change the party line, and that kind of illusion can come again, and the military need be like Lincius the watchman if they are to forfend it. I would say any time the Army drops to 12 field divisions, any cut of one or two thereafter will compound our national danger. We can afford what it takes when we can afford nothing less. Finally, I urge that strategy should be like the cross-eyed shot putter. He set no records, but he sure as hell kept the crowd on his toes. Should come the day when the USSR is certain it knows how the U.S. will react, we will be in that unhappy state Micawber described to Copperfield in lamenting his own bankruptcy. And if we are to err in our dealings with them, I say do it on the side of boldness. Yes, boldness be our friend. We had it in September 1970 during the second six-day war in the Middle East. We had it, and so did Israel. Then we lost all the advantages to power and prestige gained by the maneuver, and we again began playing turtle. We proceeded as if believing that the confrontation along the Suez line was as ready to blow as Martha Mitchell, instead of it becoming essentially a safeguard to a continuation of the standoff, with little chance that the ceasefire would be washed out. There was no realistic assessment of the military factors. I say that any time the latter obviously outweigh markedly the prospects of gain through diplomatic persuasion, it is high folly to discount, if not ignore, them. Where national strategic interest may be advanced by making the best implied use of military power, any failure to wait counsels with professional military judgment is a capital blunder. And we're making that blunder. For our decision makers and crisis managers have fallen into the noxious habit of using it as an occasional asset. And so I come to the end of my torero speech. A point here, a point there, and a lot of bull in between, and possibly a moment or so of truth. Not all bases have been touched, not all issues made Pikestaff plain, but then everybody can't be like the hero of the tale in which the Paul Bunyans of Earth, the giant loggers, gather in the Pacific Northwest for an Oregon spruce felling contest. The first giant goes at the spruce, and the timers and judges get him at 49 minutes, and then the next man comes on and he's 45 minutes. And then they go through 18 more and time them, and bringing up the rear is a little bit of a fella, dwarf-like with a very small axe, who's just crept into the party. They look at him and they can't figure what he's doing there, and he goes up against the spruce and down it comes in two whacks, and they can't believe what they see, and they try him on another tree. This time it takes him three whacks. And the chief judge looks at him in amazement and says, "Gee, fella, where did you come from?" He said, "I came from the Sahara." He said, "From the Sahara? They don't have any trees in the Sahara." And he says, "Nope, not anymore." Thank you very much.
Thank you, General. You made it in 17 and a half minutes. Fair self-discipline. David Meisel.
After General Marshall, I suppose that any discussion of economics seems even more dismal. I've really had talk about three topics this evening. Several months ago, I was asked to discuss the economic policy of the Nixon administration, and that was to give a broad view of what's happened in the last three or three and a half years. And I said I'd be very pleased to do my bit to help the program. I suggested that perhaps somebody on the inside would do better, and I suggested to Professor Coase that he get Paul McCracken. Paul turned down the invitation, and I hope that we get him at some other time. Later, when I got the... Yes. And I think in some respects that would be more interesting, because we could see, especially perhaps a little bit more remove... next year, he might be a little bit less constrained about discussing what really happened on the inside. Then when I got the printed program, it was there was an announcement that I was to talk about phase three. Well, since I really had been quite ill about both phase one and phase two, the prospect of phase three left me feeling a little unhappy. And last week at the supermarket, I saw a prop that I thought I might take along just in case anybody asked me if I really knew what phase three looked like, because it's a bar of deodorant soap, and I was going to hold it up for you. But now, this evening, it's been announced, I'm just going to talk about what's happened since, focus my attention on what's happened since the great announcements of August 15th. And much of that seems to have been the president's answer to maybe to a politician's prayer or the prayers of some economists. And it sort of reminded me of one of my favorite parrot stories. There was once a parrot that belonged to a minister, and this was a very attractive parrot, a generally well-behaved parrot, except that one day the parrot started to misbehave and started to say some awful things, and he would stomp up and down and beat his beak, she heard the story, against the cage, and to clean it up, the parrot would say, would cack a little bit and then say, let's make love. Well, the minister was very upset about this and thought that the parrot would stop that terrible chatter. But as time went by, the parrot would repeat this more frequently and more insistently. And the minister was very upset. He didn't want to do about this parrot. He didn't want to do the parrot in. And on the other hand, he didn't want to give the parrot away, because this might be a terrible provocation for less restrained people. So while he was puzzled about this, he happened to be in a pet store one day, and he saw there was another parrot. And he walked over to examine that parrot, and he heard the parrot talking, and he listened closely, and he heard the parrot murmur, "Let us pray, let us pray." And the minister thought, "My heavens, this parrot will be great. What a fine influence it will bring to bear on my own terrible parrot." So the minister bought the parrot and quickly went home and put the parrot in the cage with the parrot number one. And sure enough, parrot number one started to go through his routine, jump up and down, cack a little bit, beat his beak against the side of the cage, and he said, "Let's make love." At which point, parrot number two said, "Thank God my prayers have been answered." Now, I suspect that when President Nixon made his startling speech on August 15th, there were many people in the country who thought their prayers had been answered with respect to public policy regarding the terribly nagging problems of inflation on the one hand, and perhaps the relationship between inflation and unemployment, and also the some aspects of the balance of payments problem. Now, at the time, it seemed to me, and it seemed to large numbers of other people, that one part of the program was terrible, and the other part of the program had some elements that were quite good and was a move in the right direction, and for the same reason. That is that the attempt in phase one to set up some of the machinery of price controls and wage controls or an introduction of introduced into the federal government an element of price and wage controls which we had largely done without for some time. Whereas, with respect to the foreign exchange market, the moves that the president announced were good because it dispensed further with some of the price fixing that had taken place there. That is, the price fixing with respect to both the price of gold and, more importantly, what had happened to the price of foreign exchange. Now, we've got, I don't know how many months since phase one started, somewhat more than 6 months, and we have quite a bit of accumulated evidence that, in effect, that it seems to me that we can point to what's happened since August 15th and conclude that really not much has happened with respect to the impact of either phase one or phase two on anything that's discernible, and that the patterns that seem to have been emerging before with respect to prices and wages and the general pattern of the economy have just more or less continued. Now, to put that in perspective, let's talk for a couple of minutes about what had been happening to prices in the United States. Now, when the Nixon administration came into office, it inherited a bad inflationary situation, and one where I don't think any of us really appreciated the amount of inertia behind the inflation. Now, the inflation at that time was more serious than any we'd had in quite some time. And the Nixon administration really had very limited, it seems to me, very limited means at its disposal to do very much about the situation other than resort to monetary policy. The Nixon administration inherited the budget from the Johnson administration. The Congress was in control of the Democrats. They came in with a paper-thin majority. And whether it was a matter of intellectual or technical or ideological persuasion, or merely that there was essentially nothing else to do, it seemed that they really did turn towards more dependence on monetary policy to do something about the inflationary situation than had been the case under the Democrats. Now, in response to what seemed at the time to have been an excessive stepping on the brakes in 1969, there was a recession that started perhaps in the fall of 1969 and that perhaps ended in the fall of 1970, according to some of the people who tried to divine the entrails of business cycles. Now, during that time, prices continued to rise. In fact, through most of that period, the inflation accelerated. And it was that inflation, it was not only the continued inflation, but the accelerating inflation, that was not only a source of embarrassment and dismay to the administration, but it was also the basis for the contention of some people that something had gone wrong. And that the classical, so whatever they meant by it, that the classical rules of economics or the usual behavioral relationships had been smashed. But now, I don't believe that that's true. And in examining the path of prices in the typical business cycle, using the data collected by the National Bureau of Economic Research and kept up to date by different people in the federal government, if you look at what happens to prices during a typical business cycle, then as a general rule, after the peak is passed and business is turning down, prices continue to rise. And prices continue to rise for some time after business is turned down. And the rate of price rise is very much related to the amount of inflation we'd had before. The fact that we had prices rising in the face of increasing unemployment, falling business profits and whatnot, was really not out of line with historical precedent. There were several things that did happen during the recession, and after that, they were somewhat different. And first, one of the most important things that happened that was different was that very early in the business recession, monetary policy turned around, and that the money supplies turned up in the winter of 1970. That was really quite early in the recession. It was on the basis of that that many people predicted a turnaround of business in the fall, which took place. Now, that recession was very shallow. The decline was very modest. The rise in unemployment for that time was also relatively shallow. Now, the thing that was embarrassing was that when the expansion did take place, it was also relatively shallow, whether you compare it to the bottom of the recession or to the peak of the previous expansion. Now, it also seemed as if the inflation picture was out of control, but the inflation last spring or say early in the summer did start to taper off. And since that time, there has been a drift downward in the inflation rate. And that itself is a little unusual because typically when business picks up, the rate of inflation also picks up. And the rate of inflation picks up either right starting from the business cycle trough or within 3 to 6 months after that. And what we've observed since the summer is a tapering off. And
if you just look at the chart for prices, it's hard to see any important effect other than one little ripple that was introduced into that downward drift of the inflation rate. It's hard to discern anything but one ripple that was associated with phase one and phase two. And what all we had was, I think that the quoted statistics of prices were sort of understated for September, maybe October, maybe a little bit overstated after that. And it seems to me that the reason that the inflation rate has drifted down is precisely because of the slack in the economy that unfortunately seems to be necessary to bring the inflation rate down, and that itself is a source of embarrassment to the administration. Well, we still have the inflation unemployment dilemma, and given the pickup in economic activity, and there seem to be more and more signs of that, it seems to me that as the spring and summer wears on, if in fact we get a big expansion, then the inflation rate will stop falling, the inflation will speed up again, and perhaps we may chisel out a little bit of extra on the unemployment side. Now, during this time, there have been all the announcements from Washington, I really don't think they've had any effect. And if, in fact, there were any effect, there's a wide range of phenomena that we would expect to find, and that, in fact, many people predicted, such things as black markets, gray markets, all the wide range of things that you would predictably find whenever, in fact, you get price controls that are effective. I don't believe that we've had price controls, and I don't believe that they've been affected. But I'm not at all pleased that somehow the administration felt that it was compelled to resort to this sort of thing, perhaps in response to what the public wanted. Now, since August 15th, the administration seems to have backed off somewhat in and the Smithsonian and post-Smithsonian foreign exchange situation is still somewhat better than we had before August 15th, but we no longer have exactly a floating rate. There's an attempt to peg rates again. The gold situation is a little unclear, and I suspect that, at least for the time being, that the gold window will remain closed. And again, during all of this time, if you look at what the federal government has done with respect to the budget, expenditures continue to rise, especially on non-military purposes. Transfer payments are rising very rapidly. Grants to state and local governments are rising very rapidly. And in fact, I'm often driven to ask myself and my friends, what difference it really would have made if the paper-thin majority would have been somewhat on the other side. I think also along the same lines, I have seen no important proposal or successful attempt to change the picture with respect to regulation, with respect to laws pertaining to labor unions and other special interests. There's been no move towards freeing, other than on the foreign exchange front, towards greater freedom of trade. In fact, we may have made some moves in the opposite direction. I don't know whether that covers all the multitude of sins in such a short period of time, but perhaps in the question period we can get into some of these details more effectively.
Thank you, David. Dead on time, that was. Now, Ernest Van Den Haag.
Well, my friend, Mr. Schoenfeld, said that I'm defending error as I'm at defending truth. I wasn't sure whether I should feel flattered. But now, I find that it doesn't take very good minds to defend truth. a reasonably good mind will do, and my two predecessors have done so. It takes an exceptionally good mind, I think, to defend error, as I'm going to try to do now. Let me suggest, not only take the arguments advanced by my co-speakers, but also anticipate a few of those that one generally hears about Mr. Nixon's conduct of affairs. He's often called inconsistent and unprincipled. All I can say is that God help us if we ever get a president who puts his consistency or his principles before the welfare of the country. By principles, we mean, after all, no more than long-run rules of expediency. That is, rules that in the long run have been shown to be expedient are called principles. Those are only in the short run expedient are called expediency. Clearly, if a rule is, a principle is not in the long run expedient, it's certainly a bad principle. Now, the inconsistency that Mr. Nixon is often accused of, and not necessarily by Mr. Meiselman in this case, although partly perhaps, is that he is in favor of a free market, and yet he then proposed measures such as wage and price controls that are contrary to the free market doctrine. Certainly true, let me point out that not only he was inconsistent, but also Burns, who has a bigger economic reputation to defend than Mr. Nixon has, was certainly as inconsistent. Now, in the first place, one may say that the market, certainly in labor, hasn't been free for quite a number of years. Ideally, it should be, but it is not within Mr. Nixon's ability to make it free, as he perfectly would like. Now, the price freeze, as Mr. Meiselman pointed out very ably, was ineffective. Because it was ineffective, I would add also that it was harmless. Nothing can be both ineffective and harmful. Hence, since it was ineffective, it was quite harmless. I agree it was ineffective, although I think we could be slightly more optimistic. It had certain psychological effects, and you must remember that in domestic politics, symbolic acts play a major role. And the price freeze and subsequent various phases and so on were, I think, required as symbolic acts. People wanted to see that the administration did something about a situation that had bothered them. As Mr. Meiselman has pointed out correctly, the administration had done, on the whole, the right thing in terms of monetary and other policies. But these are not visible. People wanted to see that the administration said, in so many words, prices must not rise. So Mr. Nixon did them that favor and said, prices must not rise. Everyone feels a little happier. I don't think much harm has been done. If Mr. Nixon had taken himself seriously and instituted an elaborate apparatus to try to police the non-rise of prices, then some harm might have been done. But he hasn't done that. So I think you should regard what is going on in this respect as largely symbolic theater. And Mr. Nixon didn't invent that. That has been the meat of domestic politics for a very long time. I think it would be nice if he could change it, but it's not in his power to do so. A second reproach that, and let me point out that the price and wage freezes have not taken the place of actual effective policies. They have just been simply added. Now, the second major reproach that I understand is made against Mr. Nixon is that he went to China and is going to go to Russia. I'm not altogether sure why he should be blamed for that. In China, as I understand it, what people blame him mainly for is, quote, the betrayal of Chiang Kai-shek. Well, all I can say about this, Chiang Kai-shek is certainly familiar with betrayal. from his own experience, but at any rate, I think such melodramatic expressions have no place in foreign policy. Chiang Kai-shek has lost his position in the United Nations. Well, that may be socially embarrassing, but I think nothing that can happen in the United Nations is relevant to anything. So I can't see why this should be very important one way or the other. He may lose a few diplomatic accreditations here and there that will save money. Actually, as far the only serious matter in this is, does it mean that for one reason or other, the mainland Chinese will conquer Taipei? I don't see there's the slightest chance. They do not have at this point the power to do so. They do not have either the Air Force that would be required or the Navy. And they give no indication that they intend to do this in the foreseeable future. So nothing in this respect has changed, except, again, a few symbolic acts, which indicates that symbolic acts are important in foreign policy, too. Some people suggest that the policy has alienated Japan. Here, I think I would agree fully with the general. It has made Japan think a little bit more of the fact that it may not always be protected by us, and they may actually start paying for their own protection. I don't object at all. I think it's a very good idea. They have no choice. I mean, they cannot possibly, for obvious reasons, ally themselves with either China and Russia, so we are in no danger of losing anything. Whether the matter was handled in the best way, I do not know. There are clearly advantages when you have two major opponents, such as Russia and China, that you have relations not just with one, but also in the other, so that you are able, when the time comes, to try to play them against each other. I think the first fruit of this may be one that is almost invisible. I have for a long time feared, for various reasons, that North Korea was preparing to attack South Korea again. And I think this will not happen, and I regard this as a major possible effect. On historical matters, you never can say for certain cause and effect, but a major possible effect of the China policy, which Mr. Nixon has for many years carefully prepared, and which is now coming to a culmination. Now, it is also said about Mr. Nixon, and rightly so, in a sense, that he hasn't done enough to prepare the country militarily. But I think here the fault is much more in errors that were made in the past. Even if Mr. Nixon tried very hard to increase the military budget, there is not a chance that he could do so. It is true that a president must not just be a political leader, but also an educator. But you can be an educator only if people are willing to learn. If you preach to people something that they're obviously going to reject, you will stop being a political leader and become a professor instead. Mr. Nixon is not willing to retire to this, and I think we're fortunate that he isn't. I think any attempt on his part at this point to increase the military budget in a major way would be doomed to failure, and there is no point in making this gesture. I think it would be desirable, but I may also add a qualification. I think it would be much more desirable if I were sure that the military know how to spend the money. I don't think they do. They have been spending it very badly, the money that they have, and there are so many things wrong at this point, partly for political reasons, partly for others. I put it in a very general term, in very general terms, owing to the general attitude of this country, the military cadres have not attracted the best, the most imaginative people in the country. As a result, the military organization is very highly bureaucratized and not, in my opinion, as competent as it ought to be. I hope we will get in time a volunteer army, and I hope the president will have an occasion when this change occurs to make major changes in military organization. As it is now, I do not think it is as good as we all deserve and would like it to be. Well, I don't know how much more time I have. I want to point out that I'm by no means wholly uncritical of Mr. Nixon, though I must defend him against the major arguments that are raised against him. I am critical very largely of his neglect of domestic affairs. Now, he has, for instance, named to major offices people who are well-known and inept liberals. Well, to mention one person, former late Mr. Allen, former Commissioner of Education in New York, who was terrible there, was promptly named to federal office. But I will say that he makes these mistakes not only by naming bad liberals, he names equally bad conservatives. So he's even-handed in this. You think of the nomination of Judge Carswell, for instance, which I don't think is excusable, and other things of this sort. So, and I don't think you can say that he has a bias in favor of naming inept liberal bureaucrats. He has a bias in favor of naming inept bureaucrats, regardless. And I think he does neglect, and I hope he may change, domestic affairs. On the other hand, you have to realize that he is terribly hemmed in. It is almost impossible to get rid of the major bureaucratic impediments, even when he tries, and I think he should try harder. But nonetheless, I know it's almost impossible. It is nearly impossible to prevent Congress from setting up constantly new, totally useless, and often harmful agencies to spend billions for no reasonable effect. Mr. Nixon quite rightly vetoed the daycare center bill, a courageous act. Politically, it's always dangerous to be, quote, against children, unquote. And he vetoed it. What happened? Well, I just 10 days ago testified in Washington against a revamped version of the same act, which will be submitted to the Senate, to the Congress, and Mr. Nixon will once again either have to veto it, being a totally inveterate enemy of all children, or the something of the sort will pass. You have to remember, he has a Democratic Congress that wants to do precisely those things you and I oppose. The power of the president in this respect is not as great as you might imagine. I don't like his ideas on welfare. I'm particularly upset about the educational inflation that has been going on for many years, that he has done nothing to stop, and that he has indeed, to some extent, fostered. Sometimes I feel that he does so because he doesn't realize that to, quote, educate more people, unquote, is not going to educate them at all, but merely to cause them pretensions and ambitions that will not be fulfilled. Nonetheless, if Mr. Nixon were wholly of my opinion, I do not think he could really change that either. The Congress will vote more and more money for more and more education, and I don't know what we can do about it except try to vote against it. So let me summarize my view on this matter. I think Mr. Nixon's foreign policy I would approve in every single respect. I think his domestic economic policy has no major defects, and I do not think that we can take the price and wage controls very seriously one way or the other. I do think that there are many unfinished businesses in domestic affairs, and all I can hope for is that when we re-elect him, and he has a second 4 years when he doesn't have to be re-elected, he's able to fire some bureaucrats that he hasn't been able to fire so far. Thank you.
Thank you, Ernest. Lots of questions must clearly arise from what has been said. May we therefore have the first. And would you say to whom you are addressing the question?
President Mossman, how can we credit or blame President Nixon for the monetary policy in 69 while the Federal Reserve was being chaired by William Chesney Martin? And as to the harmlessness of, supposed harmlessness of wage and price controls, was there any additional uncertainty generated that perhaps perhaps delayed the recovery.
Well, the Federal Reserve, of course, is independent, but they read the newspapers. It's very hard to know what the connection between the White House and the Federal Reserve is. It's very hard to fault the president for the policies of the Federal Reserve or to give him credit either. And I know that there's a great deal of conflict and tension between the White House and the Federal Reserve. And in fact, the Federal Reserve has not been doing what the president would want them to do. They did not do it in 1969. Although, in general, they did move in that direction. So part of the problem with monetary management and stabilization policy in the United States is precisely the fact that the Federal Reserve legally is independent, but the president is held accountable for the consequences of the acts of the Federal Reserve. That's one of the reasons that I think it would probably be a good idea to change that arrangement. Now, in terms of the lack of effect, the general lack of effect of phase one and phase two, I think that your comment is well taken, that on the basis of the uncertainty generated by phase one, that perhaps there was less economic recovery at least for part of the fall, than we might have had without that announcement. In fact, there was a little bit of a slowdown in the recovery just at that time. Whether you can attribute it to that with any dependability or not, I'm not sure myself. I think the major defect of phase one, phase two, is not so much in terms of the pure economic effects, but in terms of the resort by government to these kinds of tactics by themselves, and the fact that it really makes a sham and a charade of much that the government does, and that I found it very upsetting that there was such a huge clack of approval on August 15th and 16th by people that I thought were wiser and had more sense. Not only in terms of the analysis of the effects of these measures, but also how happy they were to give up a wide range of prerogative and freedom for very flimsy ends. Now, I would agree with a lot. I would like to comment briefly on Ernie Vanderhaag's comment that. About President Nixon's apparent lack of interest or deep concern with domestic economic policy. Well, I'd make it stronger than that. I'd talk about leadership. And I think that one of the important functions of a leader or a president is to lead and to educate the people and to make his position known. Now, that has been singularly lacking in domestic economic policy, although the inflation is one of a large number of things that are supposed to be the single most important domestic problem. Now, there has been no public leadership either from the White House or the top leaders of the administration in explaining exactly what the problem was and what the policies of the administration were. Now, and I've made this point to some of my friends who are highly placed in Washington. They tell me about the number of speeches they've made. But that, I really don't believe there's a labor theory of value in this area any more than there is in any other. And it seems to me that that the president has exercised a high degree of leadership, whether you approve or not. The president has exercised a high degree of leadership in the area of foreign affairs. He's educated the public. He's changed policy dramatically and drastically in many respects, but he hasn't he's hardly done anything of that sort with respect to domestic economic policy. And that is, in some respects, where I would fault him the most. It's one thing to point to the constraints under which he operates, and that I can understand, but I think that there's been a great lack of leadership.
Okay, who's next?
Yes, I'd like to ask all three of our panelists what they think would have happened if Chiang Kai-shek took Mr. Buckley's advice and declared a secession, establishment of a new nation.
I would like to answer
the eyes
that.
Of international
General?
Go ahead.
Come on then, Ernest.
Absolutely no difference.
You don't think they could get back in the UN?
A new editorial for the National Review. I don't understand why you ask this question. It seems to me that to ask this question, it fails to see the difference between material and symbolic acts. So what? So what would be the difference? A different notepaper for Chiang Kai-shek, or what?
I think the invasion of Czechoslovakia had an impact.
Yes, we are speaking of an invasion. You're speaking of an invasion. If you are speaking of an invasion of Taipei, I certainly think you would understand what you're talking about, or Taiwan. So, but I thought you said declaring a secession. What do you think has been the case until now?
I wouldn't dismiss it that easily. You can't tell. This might set off a conflagration, and I think that is one reason that Chiang and his government would hesitate. That it might be the thing that would galvanize and bring Red China on. One general misunderstanding in this country, I think, has to do with the idea that the Taiwanese are themselves libertarians and bursting with the desire for freedom from Chiang, etc. There's no realization over here that there's no such thing as a Chinese or as a Taiwanese people collectively. They're divided into the same sects that they brought from the mainland 200, even 300 years ago from Fujian province. And they have nothing to do with one another. They don't socialize. They don't support one another politically. They don't intermarry. And so you've got, now, beside the Aborigines, you've got about five different Taiwanese groups. And they cannot unite on anything. The only uniting influence within the society is the nationalist influence. And as to their being objecting to Chiang and being ready to throw his government over, let's look at just one statistic. And this was true even in 1955, when the government was not very well run and the island was in a rather deplorable state, because it was just getting along with agrarianism. The cities weren't cleaned up, whereas now it is the most immaculate country in Asia. But at that time, the Taiwanese could decide whether or not they wanted to send their children to school. There was no compulsory education. If they went to school, then they were going to have to learn Mandarin, because that was the required language. And yet 75% or 97% of the children of grammar school age were in school. They accepted it.
I'd like to ask Mr. Vandenhaar a question about the harmless price control. Government has asserted its right to declare invalid on a wholesale manner all sorts of private contracts. It's been, I think, since the suspension of the Gold Clause contracts, a very long time since people could fear that the government might, at the drop of a hat, suspend contracts widely. And I'm wondering whether you think this is an effect of any consequence.
No.
No.
Marshall might speak to Mr. Van Hague's remarks as to the bureaucratization of the military and also the relative importance or lack of importance of symbolic gestures in international affairs.
I certainly agree, except for one thing, and he did not make this clear, that a large part of that has been due to the influence of the civilian secretariat. They've done more of the overbuilding than have the military. I want to say one thing about the Pentagon. There isn't anything wrong with the Pentagon that couldn't be cured with a bromine vacuum cleaner. I mean, sweep about 60% of the people out of it. It's the most, it's the worst case of elephantiasis we have in the bureaucracy. And it's growing and growing and growing. But a large part of that growth has been within the secretariat and encouraged by the secretariat. You know, we've got twice as many people there now as we had in World War II to run a war.
Harder or more difficult for future presidents to resist the same kind of demands that President Nixon faced recently?
No, I don't think it will make much difference one way or the other, but I think you put your finger on what is the serious question. If one could seriously maintain that this was an act that Mr. Nixon could have easily avoided, without political effects far worse than anything he produced by not avoiding it, then I think your question would be very justified. You would say that this leads people to believe that price controls can be effective. As a matter of fact, though, the experience that we have had is that people always want price controls, and if they get them, they get impatient with them after a fairly short time. And I don't know how often this experiment has to be repeated to persuade people, but basically, as far as the future is concerned, the best way to avoid price controls is to avoid inflation. And what we would have to educate people about is not so much price controls, but the fact that inflation follows automatically if certain policies are followed that Mr. Johnson did follow, and that once they are followed, whether we use price controls or not, we are in for a reasonably bad time in terms of restraints imposed by monetary policy with or without symbolic acts. It's very difficult to educate people on this, and what we really would require, and I agree on this, would be to re-establish more freedom on the labor market and so on. But this is simply not realistically something that any president at the present time can do successfully.
How he squares his essentially benign view of Nixon with FAP. Why does he keep pushing this monstrosity, in spite of the fact that even some liberals are getting fed up with it?
What was the monstrosity?
Family assistance.
Family assistance.
Well, he's not pushing it very much, and it's not going to go through now anyway, so I don't think you have to worry about it. But why, in particular, a piece of legislation is not withdrawn? See, when it originated largely with Milton Friedman, it was a perfectly reasonable thing. I had some objections to some features of it then, which I am on record since I wrote about it, having. But what Milton intended was a perfectly reasonable thing. What Congress finally prepared was not reasonable. Now, the logical thing for Mr. Nixon would have been then to withdraw it, perhaps, or withdraw his sponsorship. He didn't do that, but there are many political reasons that I think explain his actions. Now, if there were any serious danger of its being passed now, I would have to consider it and answer or analyze in these terms. There isn't, at this point, a serious danger. Between the time new legislation is passed, between now and that time, lots and lots of things can happen, and we'll have to see what he does. I do not think that his view is basically different from views of mine in this respect.
The idea of the price controls and Nixon's dealing with them, they were talking about the fact that this originated from presidents past. Well, do you think that actually either of the people who want to deal with the economic aspect, do you think that actually the majority of the people in the country ever consider that an economic problem goes back further than the president who's in when he's having to deal with it? In other words, don't they think that he... Well, in other words, don't you think that this idea of the price controls, they don't understand anything about the fact that he... In other words, don't you think the majority of the American people probably think that Nixon caused it?
Caused what? He did cause the price control.
No, he caused the problems
that
supposedly the price controls was an answer for.
Yeah, well, that's what Nixon certainly... he was in a situation in which there was inflation, which people didn't attribute necessarily to him, but they attributed to him not doing enough about it. Now, what can actually be done takes a while and has nothing to do with price controls. But price controls are accepted by people as a thing that ought to be done. Now, let me point out, though, that I tend to agree, though it will embarrass a little bit, with Mr. Meiselman, who pointed out that perhaps recovery was somewhat retarded by people being confused about what is to be expected. That is, what Mr. Meiselman here proposed was a psychological variable influencing recovery. If psychological variables can influence recovery, then of course it can also influence inflation. And it is possible, of course, that people, if they believe in price controls, that these price controls will have a certain amount of a placebo effect. I think vitamin C doesn't really help you in any physiological sense against a cold, but on the other hand, if you believe in vitamin C, it may help you. People believe in price controls, perhaps they feel better about it, and after all, that is what is in some ways important. So I don't really, if your question is, did people attribute the inflation to Mr. Nixon? I don't think it works that way. What people said was, he isn't doing enough about it. And they would have accused him of failing to stop it if he hadn't engaged in these symbolic acts, which are symbolic acts, since they are complemented by very real measures that have been taken, will reduce inflation somewhat.
I'd like to comment on that. Sorry. I really don't think that we have any evidence that that these symbolic acts have very much effect on inflation. I've been studying inflation for most of my professional life.
David, I agree with you.
And other than perhaps a little ripple here and there, at most, that's about all that they would do. And I would hope that rather than depend on having the president get out on the balcony and make the kinds of speeches that other presidents and leaders have been making around the world for the last few generations, that have none of which have ever worked, that the president would have exercised a different kind of leadership to prepare the ground for a more effective stabilization program and also to have made it politically more feasible to introduce a wider range of policies
that would have been effective both in slowing down the inflation, doing something about the mess in the labor market, and which would have helped to avoid a lot of the waste that we've had for at least the last few years.
I don't disagree in what you are in favor of. Let me make two points. The evidence for speeches influencing inflation is as good as the influence for speeches influencing recovery. That is non-existent. But since you maintain that speeches did influence recovery, I think with exactly the same amount of demonstration, I can maintain that they influence inflation. If you're willing to say they don't influence recovery, I'm willing to say they don't influence inflation.
No, what I meant to, what maybe you didn't understand me correctly because I didn't speak clearly enough to the point about the impact of the August 15th speech. It wasn't so much the speech, but it was the controls that were set up. And on August 15th, they were very vague with a promise that more would have come later. People didn't know what phase two was going to be. All they knew that within 90 days, there was something different was going to happen. And given the uncertainty of that time, that perhaps on the basis of that, not the symbolic gesture, that that may have caused a bit of a slowdown. That was a real act, promising more.
But I'm sorry, promising is not an act, it's promising. And what you are saying is that the promises or threats had a psychological influence, and let me say once more, the same may be true about inflation. There is, as we both agree, no demonstration either way. But as to your second point, namely that the task of the president is to be an educator, I think it is certainly partially true. But I think you're going too far. If he becomes an educator to the point of telling people something that they're unwilling to learn at this point, then he is no longer a president. He is only an educator. And I think you are in a position to do that, and it is your task to do that, and it is my task to do that. It is not the task of the president. The president is, as you pointed out correctly, a leader. A leader has the task of making sure, A, to lead in the right direction, and B, to be followed. It doesn't help him to walk alone in the right direction and not to be followed. Then he isn't a leader, he's an educator. I've been doing it for years.
You're a leading educator.
And here, surely, the imposition of price controls, even on paper, is never a wholly symbolic act. Of course, it doesn't stop inflation. It doesn't restrain it. It may not slow it even. It may even accelerate it. But the attempt at stopping inflation or restraining inflation by price controls, even on paper, does have some distorting effect. And the experience of Britain is absolutely clear in that respect. Then the question arises, what is the ultimate educational effect of this? When the price controls clearly fail to moderate inflation, do the people learn the correct lesson from that? Or are they plunged deeper into error? And the answer generally is the latter.
Yeah.
They're plunged deeper into error. Still that first, though.
I was about to make that very point, sir. And I didn't want to intervene because I felt I differed so fundamentally with some of the things that have been said that I felt I shouldn't throw a spanner into the works. But the truth about inflation is that inflation is never successful unless its fundamental technique succeeds. And the fundamental technique is something which is called creating the correct climate of opinion. Now that means deceiving the mass of people about the planned speed or the planned duration of inflation. That has always been necessary. The Manchester Guardian in Britain some years ago called it the technique of necessary untruth. Now, in order to mislead the people about inflation, various devices have been invented. And one of the devices is, at a particular time, when you've got stagflation, as it's been called, when you've got costs rising in anticipation of higher prices later, then the whole purpose of inflation is destroyed. The purpose of inflation is to make good the wages flow, which wage rates forced up unduly high are reducing. You allow the labor unions to reduce the reduce the wages flow, the opposite of what the public believe, in order to prevent recession due to the destruction of the source of demand. You make it up by additional money units. Now, in order to be able to keep the process going, now and again, the rate of inflation has to slow down. And inflation goes up in a series of layers. When it slows down, that reassures people. Now, one of the techniques is price control. Your cost of living commission, your pay board, and so forth, all that paraphernalia is reassuring the public, and I believe that when this breaks down after the presidential election, you're going to have a wonderful inflationary binge. That's what I'm feeling. That's what I'm fearing. I believe the fundamental point is being lost. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. I didn't want to intervene tonight because I felt...
Not only will they have in this country that binge, this will follow exactly what we have had. We're having that binge right now as a result of the attempts to control prices from 1964 exactly. to 1968.
The British experience now is ignored in the United States, completely ignored, the current British experience.
Okay, now you made your point. Now let's see, wait a moment. So,
the papers inform us that the European bankers hold about $66 billion of our dollars, of our money. We have a very prominent banker in Chicago who has suggested that we buy up the stocks on the exchange, the government, and sell them at a certain price to those bankers. And I'd like to ask the economist what he thinks of the very novel approach.
I think if the Europeans want to buy our stocks, let them do it. I don't see why we have to sell it to them at a cut rate.
Anyway, it's a misunderstanding of the availability of those dollars. They are part of the reserves, the central bank reserves, and a central bank, the central bank of Timbuktu, may not be inclined, almost certainly won't be inclined, to put the reserves in American stocks.
If the Europeans don't want to hold those dollars, they can do other things with them. They can. They don't hold them in the form of cash. They don't hold them essentially in the form of deposits at U.S. banks. They have dollar assets, which are maybe U.S. securities or property in the United States. It's not as if they have this IOU on the United States that they can pull immediately. Now, I think that the United States has paid too much attention to the balance of payments, and I would subscribe to the general policy that Gottfried Habula called benign neglect. I think in general we just ought to forget about it. And if the foreigners want to hold the dollars, let them hold the dollars. If they don't want to hold the dollars, they don't have to hold the dollars. They can set it to essentially any rate of exchange of their currency for the dollar that they wish. We're in a uniquely wonderful position that in many respects we don't have to do anything.
One economist who hasn't ignored the English experience. I'm in a squabble with Tobin on the subject, which he's prevented from being published so far. Will be out next month. But anyway, before this thing, first place, in the last year, European central bankers have made gifts to us Americans of $20 billion by buying that much of our bonds. And I, for one, hope that they remain just as stupid as they are now. If we can get them to buy $20 billion worth of our bonds every year, we're in. I might add, by the way, that Karl Brunner was asked by the Swiss Central Bank to advise them what they should do with their bank holdings, and he said they should buy control of General Motors. And they refused to be serious. But the other thing is that there is another byproduct of the inflation, et cetera, and that is, in real terms, the credit of the United States is a trinity. Nobody seems to know this, but in real terms, the value of government bonds held by American citizens fell by almost 50%.